talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light that split.
Never allow private banks to control the issue of their money. First by inflation, then by deflation. The banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. Americans, living in what is called the richest nation on earth, seem always to be short of money. Wives are working in unprecedented numbers. Husbands hope for overtime hours to earn more or take part-time jobs, evenings and weekends. Children look for odd jobs for spending money. And the family debt climbs higher. And psychologists say one of the biggest causes of family quarrels and breakups is arguments over money. Much of this trouble can be traced to our present debt money system. Too few Americans realize why Christian statesmen wrote into Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, "Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof." They did this in prayerful hope that it would prevent the love of money from destroying the republic they had founded. Amongst other things, in this series, we shall see how subversion of Article 1 has brought us the evil of which God's word had warned. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, and welcome to a special edition of Perspectives on America. I am your host for the series, Jeffrey Bennett. The series, The Mask of Demetrios. In tonight's installment, Part 1, Prelude to a Game. For money, some men will allow the innocent to hang. They will turn traitor. They will lie, cheat, steal, and they will kill. They appear brilliant and charming and generous, but they are deadly. Such are men as Demetrios. Let us take a bit of time here and go back a little ways to understand the Federal Reserve. We need to lay the groundwork for where this series is going to ultimately go throughout the course of this next 4 hours. Instead of the constitutional method of creating our money and putting it into circulation, today we now have an entirely unconstitutional system, and this has resulted in almost disastrous conditions, as I hope we will see. Since our money was handled both legally and illegally before 1913, this series of programs will primarily consider the years following 1913, since from that year on, all of our money has been created and issued by an illegal method that will eventually destroy this nation. Prior to 1913, America was a prosperous, powerful, and growing nation, at peace with its neighbors and the envy of the world. But in December 1913, Congress, with many members away from the Christmas holidays, passed what has since been known as the Federal Reserve Act. Omitting the burdensome details here, it's simply authorized the establishment of a Federal Reserve Corporation with a board of directors to run it. And the United States was divided into 12 Federal Reserve districts. And that simple but terrible law completely removed from Congress the right to create money or to have any control over its creation, and gave that function to the Federal Reserve Corporation. This was done with appropriate fanfare and propaganda that this would remove money from politics. Of course, they didn't say, and therefore from the people's control. And all of this was designed to prevent these so-called boom and bust cycles from hurting our citizens. The people were not told then. And few even know this fact today, that the Federal Reserve Corporation is a private corporation controlled by international banksters and is therefore operated for the financial gain of those banksters over the people rather than for the good of the people. The word federal was used only to deceive those people. Since that day of infamy, more disastrous to us than Pearl Harbor, the small group of privileged people who lend us our money have accrued to themselves all of the profits of printing our money and more. Since 1913, they've created tens of billions or trillions of dollars in money and credit, which, as their own personal property, they then lend to our government and our people, you and I, at interest or usury. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and that had become the secret policy of our national government. Economists use the term create when speaking of the process by which money comes into existence. Now, creation means making something that did not exist before. Lumbermen make boards from trees. Workers build houses from lumber, and factories manufacture automobiles from metal and glass and other materials. But in all of these, they did not create. They only changed existing materials into a more usable and therefore more valuable form. But you see, that's not the case with money. Here and here alone, man actually creates something out of nothing. A piece of paper of little value is printed so that it is worth a piece of lumber. And with different figures, it can buy the automobile or even the house. Its value has been created in the true meaning of the word. Now, first of all, my friends, money unto itself is very cheap to make. And whoever does the creating of that money in a nation can make a tremendous profit. Builders work hard to make a profit of 5% above their cost to build a home. Automobile manufacturers sell their, or dealers sell their cars for 1-2% above the actual cost of manufacture. And that's considered good business. But money manufacturers, they have no limit on their profit, since a few cents will print a $1 bill or a $10,000 bill. That profit, in some respects, is part of our story. But first, let us consider another unique characteristic of this thing we call money, the love of which is the root of all evil and the men who brought us the evil Federal Reserve System. An adequate supply of money is indispensable to civilized society. We could forego many other things, but without money, industry would grind to a halt. Farms would become only self-sustaining units. Surplus food would disappear. Jobs requiring the work of more than one man or one family would remain undone, and shipping and large movements of good would cease. Hungry people would plunder and kill to remain alive, and all government except family or tribe would cease to function. Is that an overstatement, you say? Not at all. Money is the blood of civilized society, and maybe uncivilized society as well, the means for all commercial trade except simple barter. It is the measure and the instrument by which one product is sold and another purchased. Remove money or even reduce the supply below that which is necessary to carry on current levels of trade, and the results are catastrophic. For an example, we need only look at America's depression of the early 1930s. In 1930, some months after the manipulated stock market collapse of 1929, which we introduced you to in the series All the King's Men, America did not lack industrial capacity. We had fertile farmland and skilled and willing workers or industrious farm families. We had all of this going for us. But America had an extensive and highly efficient transportation system in the railroads and the road networks and inland and ocean waterways. Communications between regions and localities were the best in the world, utilizing telephone and teletype radio, and a well-operated government mail system. No war had ravaged the cities or the countryside. No pestilence weakened our population, and nor had famine stalked the land. The United States of America in 1930 lacked only one thing, an adequate supply of money to carry on trade and commerce. In the early 1930s, bankers, the only source of new money and credit, deliberately refused loans to industries and stores and farms. Payments on existing loans were required, however, and money rapidly disappeared from circulation. Goods were available to be purchased, jobs waiting to be done, but the lack of money brought the nation to a standstill. By this simple ploy, America was put into a depression, and the greedy bankers took possession of hundreds of thousands of farms and homes and business properties. The people were told that times are hard and money is short. And not understanding the system, they were cruelly robbed of their earnings, their savings, and their property. World War II ended the Depression. The same bankers who in the early 1930s had no loans for peacetime houses or food and clothing suddenly had unlimited billions to lend for army barracks, K-rations, uniforms. A nation that in 1934 could not produce food for sale suddenly could produce bombs to send free to Germany and Japan. And with the sudden increase in money, people were hired. Farms sold their produce, factories went to two shifts, mines reopened, the Great Depression was over, hallelujah. We're in the money. Some politicians were blamed for it, others took credit for ending it. The truth is, the lack of money caused by the bankers brought on the Depression, and adequate money ended it. The people were never told that simple truth, and in this series of programs, we will endeavor to show how these same bankers who control our money and credit have used their control to plunder America and place us in bondage. And yet, in fact, our true goal of this series, The Mask of Demetrius, is to take us even back further in history, to show us who, ultimately, was responsible, who were the masterminds of what our banking system became, and what was their mindset. But before we get to that, we're going to talk a little bit about the need for money. The federal government, having spent more than it has taken from its citizens in taxes, needs, for the sake of argument, let's say $1 trillion. Now, since it does not have the money, and Congress has given away its authority to create it, the government must go to the creators for the $1 billion, not trillion. But you see, the Federal Reserve, a private corporation, doesn't just give its money away. The bankers are willing to deliver $1 billion in money or credit to our federal government in exchange for the government's agreement to pay it back with interest. And so Congress authorizes the Treasury Department to print $1 billion in U.S. bonds, which are then delivered to the Federal Reserve bankers. That's collateral. In other words, the Federal Reserve is biting off a piece of America to ensure that they get paid back. Well, the Federal Reserve then pays the cost of printing $1 billion, which, by the way, is only about $1,000, and the exchange is made. The government then uses the money to pay its obligations. And what are the results of this fantastic transaction? Well, $1 billion in government bills are paid, all right, but the government has now indebted the people to the bankers for $1 billion on which the people must pay interest. And tens of thousands, if not millions, of such transactions, my friends, have taken place since that crucial year of 1913, so that by the 1980s, the U.S. government was indebted to the bankers for over $1 trillion, on which the people paid over $100 billion a year in interest alone, with no hope of ever paying off the principal. And now, over 20 years later, the debt has grown by nearly seven times that of the 1980s, and supposedly our children and following generations are going to pay forever and ever and ever. Oh, and yet there's more. Ho, 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 ho. You say this is terrible? Well, my friends, it is. But we've shown only part of the sordid story. Under this unholy system, those United States bonds have now become assets of the banks in the reserve system, which they then use as reserves to create more credit to lend. Reserve requirements allow them to use that $1 billion in bonds to create as much as $15 billion more new dollars in new credit to lend to the states and the municipalities, to individuals and businesses. Add that to the original $1 billion, they now could have $16 billion with the created credit out in loans, paying them interest with only their cost being the original $1,000 for printing the original $1 billion. Since the U.S. Congress has not issued constitutional money since 1863, in order for the people to have money to carry on trade and commerce, they are forced to borrow the created money of the monopoly bankers and pay them usury interest. Oh, by the way, there was a short period of time where constitutional money was issued in this country. It was in 1963. And a matter of months after the issuance of that constitutional money, the president who authorized its circulation and issuance, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated. And his successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson, immediately quashed the constitutional money and went back into business with the international banksters. But there's still more. In addition to the vast wealth drawn to them through this almost unlimited usury, the bankers who control the money at the top are able to approve or disapprove large loans to large and successful corporations to the extent that refusal of a loan will bring about a reduction in the price that that corporation's stock sells for on the market. And after depressing the price, the banker's agents buy large blocks of that stock, after which the sometimes multi-million dollar loan is approved, the stock rises, and then is sold for a profit. And in that manner, billions of dollars are made with which to buy more stock. This practice is so refined today that the Federal Reserve Board need only announce to the newspapers an increase or decrease in their rediscount rate to send stocks up or down as they wish. Once again, using that method since 1913, the bankers and their agents have purchased secret or open control of almost every large corporation in America. And using that control, they then force the corporations to borrow huge sums from their banks so that corporations' earnings are siphoned off in the form of interest to those same banks. Well, that leaves little as to actual profits which could be paid as dividends, and that explains why stock prices are so depressed at various different times, while the banks reap billions of dollars in interest from corporate loans. In effect, the bankers get almost all of the profits, while individual stockholders are left holding the bag. The millions upon millions of working families in America are now indebted to the few thousand banking families for at least twice the assessed value of the entire United States. I believe it's much greater than that. I believe it's at least seven times the assessed value of the entire U.S. Those banking families obtained that debt against us for the cost of paper, printing and ink, and a little bit of bookkeeping. Now, the only way that new money, which is not true money, but credit representing a debt, the only way that new money goes into circulation in America is when it is borrowed from the bankers. When the state and people borrow large sums, we seem to prosper. However, the bankers create only the amount of the principal of each loan, never the extra amount needed to pay the interest. And therefore, the new money never equals the new debt added. The amounts needed to pay the interest on loans is not created and therefore does not exist. Under this kind of system, my friends, where new debt always exceeds the new money, no matter how much or how little is borrowed, the total debt increasingly outstrips the amount of money available to pay the debt. The people can never, ever, ever get out of debt. Consider this. In 1910, the U.S. federal debt was only $1 billion. That equated to $12.40 per citizen. State and local debts were practically non-existent. By 1920, after only 6 years of the Federal Reserve shenanigans, the federal debt had jumped to $24 billion, or $228 per person. By 1960, the federal debt had reached $284 billion, or $1,575 per citizen, and state and local debts were beginning to mushroom. And by 1981, the federal debt passed $1 trillion and was growing exponentially as the bankers tripled the interest rates. State and local debts are now more than the federal. And with business and personal debts, it totaled over $6 trillion, three times the value of all land and buildings in America. But my friends, the story is compounded. During the administration of George W. Bush, the federal debt has surpassed the $7 trillion level. The $7 trillion level, and that equates to about $25,000 per citizen. And yet if we signed over to the moneylenders all of America, we would still owe them 14 more Americas, plus their usury, of course. The value of 14 more Americas will only pay the principal. But you see, they're too cunning to take title to everything, at least on the surface. Oh, they will instead leave you with some illusion of ownership, so that you and your children will continue to work and pay the bankers more of your earnings in ever-increasing debts. The establishment has captured our people with their ungodly system of usury and debt as certainly as if they had marched in with a uniformed army. Where does the responsibility of this debacle originate? Who were the perpetrators of this massive check-kiting scheme which has brought America to its knees? In this series, The Mask of Demetrios, we hope to bring the truth to the surface. I will be back.
Interest come about, a dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about, a dollar in, a dollar out? How does interest come about, a dollar in, a dollar out? How does interest come about? You say my opinions are not fact. I want to ask you, is it opinion and is death in tax? A dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about? A dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about? A dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about? A dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about? You say reality is what you please. I wanna ask you, does water freeze at 32 degrees? A dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about? A dollar in, a dollar out. Interest come about, a dollar in, a dollar out. How does interest come about, a dollar in, a dollar out? How does interest come about?
It has been said that Jewish bankers exercise their large measure of control because they are abler than the other bankers. The great Jewish banking houses of the United States are foreign importations, as perhaps everyone knows. Most of them were, at one time, sufficiently recent to be considered in their immigrant status, while the thought of them as aliens was and still are stimulated by their retention of overseas connections. It is this international quality of the Jewish banking group which has largely accounted for Jewish financial power. There has remained team play, intimate understandings, and while there remains a margin of competition among themselves, just as in a game of golf, there's also a wiping out of that margin when it comes to a contest between Jewish and Gentile capital. Four conspicuous names in Jewish American finance were Belmont, Schiff, Warburg, and Kahn. Each of them were of foreign origin. August Belmont was the earliest and arrived in America in 1837 as the American representative of the Rothschilds, in whose offices he had been raised. His birthplace was that great center of Jewish international finance, Frankfurt on the Main. He became the founder of the Belmont family in America, which has largely forgotten its Jewish roots. Politics was a part of his concern in this country, and during the critical time from 1860 to 1872, he was chairman of the National Democratic Committee. His management of the Rothschild interest was exceedingly profitable to that house, although the operations in which he engaged were quite simple compared to the operations of present day. Jacob Schiff was another Jewish financier who was given to the world by Frankfurt on the Main. He entered the United States in 1865 after having passed his apprenticeship in the office of his father, who was also an agent of the Rothschilds. The name Schiff runs a long way back without change, unlike the name of Rothschild. As we have shared with you in the past, the Rothschild family was originally named Bauer. Family of financiers took a new name from the red shield which adorned their house in the Jewish section of Frankfurt, and thus became Rothschild. Commonly, the last syllable is pronounced as if it were child, but it is in fact Schild, or Shield. An epic-making family in itself, it has trained hundreds of agents and apprentices, of whom Jacob H. Schiff was one. He became one of the principal channels through which German-Jewish capital flowed into American undertakings, and his agency in these matters gave him a place in many important departments of American business, especially railroads, banks, insurance companies, telegraph companies. He married Teresa Loeb, and in due time came to be the head of the firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company. Now, Schiff as well was interested in politics with a Jewish angle, however, and was perhaps the moving force in the campaign which forced Congress and the president to break off, the then president, to break off treaty relations with Russia, then a friendly nation, by the way, on a strictly Jewish question which had been skillfully given an American aspect. Mr. Schiff was of inestimable assistance to Japan in the war against Russia, but is understood to have been disappointed by Japan's shrewdness in preventing too high a return being made for that assistance. Associated with Schiff in Kuhn Loeb and Company was Otto Hermann Kahn, who was probably more international than were either of the two gentlemen previously mentioned, and is more constantly engaged in dabbling in mysterious matters of an international nature. This characteristic may be accounted for, however, by his experience of the many countries. Kahn was born in Germany and is also a product of the Frankfurt on the Main School of Finance, having had connection with the Frankfurt Jewish House of Speer. Of just how many countries Kahn has been a citizen is a question not easy to determine because of the doubt that was once cast upon his American citizenship by a protest against his being permitted to cast his vote in the previous year, and by his failure, the announced cause being physical indisposition, to cast his vote. If Kahn had been a citizen of the United States, a status that would be readily proclaimed upon proof that he had been, that probably increases the number of his citizenships to at least three. He was a German citizen by birth, served in the German army. In 1914, in August, at the time of the outbreak of the European War, when efforts were being made, which afterwards succeeded, to put Paul M. Warburg, a member of the firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company, on the Federal Reserve Board. Warburg testified that at the time, Kahn was not a citizen of the United States. Senator Bristow asked, "How many of these partners are American citizens, or are they all Americans?" Warburg responded, "They are all American citizens except Mr. Kahn." Now, if you're wondering where we're getting this testimony from, it was in effect published on page 7 of the Senate hearings, dated August 1st, 1914, less than 1 year after the Federal Reserve Act had been signed. Bristow continues, "Now, the members of your firm, are they all American citizens except Kahn?"
"Except Mr. Kahn, yes."
"Was Mr. Kahn ever an American citizen?"
"No."
"He never was?"
"No, he's a British subject. He lives in England, does he not?"
Warburg says, "No, at one time he thought he would move to Europe, and that was when the question arose of his standing for Parliament, and then he changed his mind and moved back to the United States." Bristow says, "He was at one time a candidate, or a prospective candidate for Parliament, was he not?"
"No, he was not, but there was talk about it. It had been a suggestion, and he had it in his mind. Something had been written about it in the papers."
So you see, if Kahn had been a citizen of the United States at the time, which, as a matter of fact, had been disputed, then he had been a citizen of three countries, Germany and Great Britain being the other two. Now, Kahn, by the way, was one of those Jews whose adoption of another form of faith brought no denunciation whatever from the Jews themselves. A most peculiar circumstance, if you consider it, but doubtless not inexplicable. Kahn was not called a renegade Jew, nor any of the other nasty names heaped upon Jewish converts to Christianity, because he did not deserve them. They, in fact, did not fit him. He was not renegade. And he never was regarded for a moment by Jacob Schiff as anything but a Jew. And otherwise, that Prince of Israel, Schiff, would not have chosen him to remain in America and run the business of Kuhn Loeb & Company at a time when it seemed undesirable to put the junior Schiff in full charge of it. Doubtless it was Kahn's desire, just at the time Jacob Schiff made his wishes known, to go to England and stand for Parliament. But from New York he fulfills, probably as well as he could from London, those mysterious missions which frequently took him to the continent, at which times he made what are regarded as certain authoritative decisions, though just whose decisions it is not always possible to say. In Paris, in particular, and at points east thereof, Kahn had been established in the position of a spokesman of the American financial hierarchy, which, of course, he was not, but he undoubtedly was the spokesman of some group, possibly the group that so ably put through the Jewish program at the peace conference, the group that impressed Eastern Europe with the feeling that the United States of America was a very powerful Semitic empire. Kahn's trips abroad were usually unheralded, but their results richly repaid observation. Now, there was a fourth member of the Jewish financial group in America, which is the form of statement which Mr. Chaim Weizmann would sanction, rather than to say Jewish American financiers, was one Mr. Paul Warburg, to whose testimony we have just recently alluded. Warburg was the most recent arrivee of all. He had been born in Germany in 1868, came to the United States in 1902, became an American citizen in 1911. He came to the United States for the express purpose of reforming our financial system, and it is hardly possible to understand fully the system in operation today without reference to Paul Warburg. He was a man of very fine mind, a moneymaker, but something more, a shrewd student of the systems by which money was made. Now, there are two types engaged in the mere work of money-making, which is better described as money-getting, without reference to production. One type grubs away under whatever system obtains, regarding it as fixed as the solar system. Another type is sufficiently detached to see the system as an artifice that may be mended, remodeled, or supplanted altogether. Warburg, scion of a long line of German Jewish bankers, is of the latter type. He was not content with the fact that the cash register filled itself with money. He also wanted to know how the cash register worked and whether it can be reworked. He was thus a student of money and of the number of ways in which it could be manipulated. Now, perhaps it would be best to let Warburg tell his own story as far as he goes. When he told it to the Committee on Banking and Currency of the United States Senate in executive session, there was some dispute as to whether the proceedings should be recorded by stenographer. It was finally agreed that notes should be made but should not be divulged. The testimony was printed, in confidence, of course, on August the 5th, 1914, nominally made public, as it were, on August the 12th. Once again, please keep in mind, all of this that we share with you, this testimony, all took place in less than a year after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. The Warburgs, as I believe we've well established by now, were one of the international families whose importance was not realized until World War I, and would not have been realized then if their internationalism had not been so bloody apparent. It was an interesting spectacle to see brothers occupying important places of counsel on either side of the great struggle. Oh, that's right. We've shared this story with you for many years on the air. The settlement of World War I. You had Paul Warburg representing the so-called Allies, if that was the proper word used then, in the financial dissertation and negotiations for the settlement of peace. His brother Max, representing the same banking house, sat on the other side of the table, representing the Axis powers, although once again, I don't believe they were called Axis at the end of World War I. Now, Warburg, to give you a little bit more background, learned the rudiments of banking in his father's bank at Hamburg, Germany, studying the overseas trade that is the foundation of that city's business. The banking house of Warburg in Hamburg dates all the way back to 1796. In Warburg's own words,
"After that, I went to England, where I stayed for 2 years, first in the banking and discount firm of Samuel Montague and Company, and after that, I took the opportunity of staying 2 months in the office of a stockbroker in order to learn that part of the business. After that, I went to France, where I stayed in a French bank, so that..."
"What French bank was that?" the chairman of the proceedings asked.
"It's the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade, which has an agency in Paris. And after that, I went back to Hamburg and worked there again for a year, I think. And then I went around to India and China and Japan. And then I came to this country for the first time in 1893. But I stayed here only a short time and then went back to Hamburg and then became a partner with the firm in Hamburg."
And the chairman asks, "How long were you in Hamburg then in the banking business?"
"Until 1902. Then I moved over here to this country to become a partner of Kuhn Loeb & Company. I explained in the curriculum which I gave you, Mr. Chairman, that by marriage I am related to members of the firm, the late Mr. Loeb having been my father-in-law, which brought about a desire on the part of the family to bring me over here. I ought to say that I got married in this country in 1895, and that I've been in this country every year since, for several months. That's the history of my banking education."
Well, it would be recalled that Jacob Schiff also married a daughter of Mr. Loeb, so that Mr. Warburg married the sister of Mrs. Jacob H. Schiff. Felix Warburg, Paul's brother, who was also in the firm, married Mrs. Schiff's daughter. You talk about incestuous relationships. It's not unlike the monarchies of Europe, who have been intermarrying cousins and aunts and uncles and sisters and brothers, etc., for hundreds of years. Very much the same kind of things took place throughout the international banking community. Now, Warburg immediately cast a critical eye upon the state of financial affairs in the United States, and it should be looked upon as significant of the grasp that by that time he already had on such matters that he found the country what he called rather behind the times. Now, he conceived the ambition, the very daring ambition, of taking hold of the United States monetary system and making it what he thought it ought to be. Now, that alone would have made him a very remarkable man, and it illustrates very well the detached point of view which the Jew is more fitted to take than any other man, perhaps. He sees countries and systems with the same freedom from intimate bias with which another man would view assorted fish upon a market stall. Most of the world was engaged in doing its work and indulging its national and racial and domestic and social affections and inclinations. A small minority stood in the background and watched the entire mass as at its unconscious maneuvers and studied it as an observer studied a hive of bees. You see, the man at work has no time except for his job. One man, standing back and studying 1,000 men at work, is able to see how he might utilize their labor or possess himself of a first toll on their production. Toll being a polite word for tax, would you not say? Doubtless there must be men to stand up at a sufficient distance from things to get a correct idea of their interrelationship. And doubtless such an attitude may be made of great service to the race, but doubtless it has also contributed to the selfish manipulation of natural and social processes. Warburg subsequently continued his testimony before the congressional hearings when he said, "When I came here, I was at once impressed by the lack of system, by the old-fashioned nature of the system that prevailed here. And I got immediately into one of those periods of high interest rates where call money went up 25% and 100%. And I wrote an article on the subject then and there for my very own benefit. Well, I was not here for 3 weeks before I was trying to explain to myself the roots of the evil. I showed the article to a few friends, but I kept it in my desk because I didn't want to be one of those who try to inform and educate the country after they'd been here for a month or so. So I kept the article until the end of 1906. Shortly before the panic, when those conditions arose once again, and when one newspaper wanted for an issue at the end of the year an article dealing with the conditions in our country. Then I took out the article, I touched it up, brought it up to date, and that was the first article of mine that was published. It was called Defects and Needs of Our Banking System. That was, however, the first time that I know of that the question of the discount system and the concentration of reserves was really brought out. And I got a great many encouraging letters asking me to go on and explain my ideas." Well, Warburg, as you can well imagine, was perfectly willing to talk to the committee about himself, but not about Kuhn Loeb and Company, his firm. "I cannot discuss the affairs of my firm or my partners, nor be asked to criticize the acts of my partners, either to approve of them or in any other way." But eventually he did tell a number of things which students of American financial affairs have over the years considered quite interesting, but we may share some of that with you later in this series. On page 77 of the testimony, more personal matter appears. Senator Bristow asked, "When did you become a citizen of the United States, Mr. Warburg?"
1911. Did I not answer that?
"Perhaps so. Did you intend to become a citizen when you came to the United States in 1902?
I had no definite intentions then, because some of the reasons that brought me over here were family reasons. They had a good deal to do with my first coming here, and I was not at all sure that I would stay here when I came."
"When did you decide to become a citizen of the United States?"
"In 1908, when I took out my papers."
"When you first took out your papers?" "You took out your second papers then in 1911.
Yes.
You made your declaration in 1908. That is when you decided to become an American citizen?
Yes.
Why did you wait as long as you did after you came to this country before deciding to become a citizen of this country?
Well, I think that a man that does not come here as an immigrant, a man who has had, if you may call it such, a prominent position in his own country, will not give up his nationality so easy as a man who comes over here knowing that he does not care for his own country at all. I've been a very loyal citizen of my own country, and I think that a man who hesitates in giving up his own nationality and taking a new one is apt to be more loyal to his new country when he does change his nationality than a man who gives up his old country more lightly.
Yes.
I may add this, that a thing which had a great deal of influence on my making up my mind to remain in this country and work here and become a part and parcel of this country was that monetary reform work, for I felt I had a distinct duty to perform here, and I thought I could do that. And in fact, I've been working on it since 1906, 1907. Then I felt that it was the right thing for me to become an American citizen and work here and throw in my lot definitely with this country.
When you became an American citizen, Senator Bristow continues, and the motive which induced you to become an American citizen was, then, as I understand it, largely with a view of laboring to bring about a reform of the American monetary system?
Well, you put it nearly exclusively on that. I think a man wants to feel that he's going to do some useful work in his country, that he has a mission to perform, and that is what happened to me. Moreover, I had been long enough in this country then to have thoroughly taken root and feel that I was a part and parcel of it.
Yes. When did you first become active in promoting the monetary reforms in the United States?
In 1906.
What was your method of promoting your ideas with regard to monetary reforms?
Mainly writing.
Were you connected with the Monetary Commission?
No, not directly.
Were you consulted in regard to the report of the Monetary Commission in any way?
Yes, Senator Aldrich consulted with me about the details, and I gave him my advice freely.
And in regard to the bill, which was prepared by Senator Aldrich in connection with the commission, were you consulted in regard to that?
Yes.
What part did you have in the preparation of that bill, directly or indirectly?
Well, only that I gave the best advice that I could give.
Well, most of our listeners will recall that the name of Aldrich was the synonym for the money power in government. Senator Aldrich was an able man and a tireless worker. His character for thoroughness and industry did more than anything else to disabuse the popular mind of the notion that such men were mere tools of the money interest, or engaged in their work out of lust for gain or out of sheer pleasure in legislating against the interests of the people. Senator Aldrich led on tariff and financial matters because he understood them. And he understood them by tireless study of them, and therefore he was the master of other men who had not paid the price of knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to reemphasize that which I have just read. Senator Aldrich led on tariff and financial matters because he understood them. Now, that's not the key. Here is the part that's the key of this sentence. He understood them because he conducted a tireless study of them and therefore was the master of other men who had not paid the price of knowledge. Do you understand the meaning of that? This is what we have spent nearly 9 years on the air, trying to teach and give you that knowledge so that you could become the master of other men who did not have this knowledge. But you see, Aldrich understood these matters from the standpoint of the business interests only. He was sincerely desirous of the prosperity of the country, but that prosperity was written only in bank balances. 100 and some odd years ago, you know, it might not have been possible to judge thus calmly, because then he represented in the public mind more than any individual does today. Aldrich understood the concentrated power of a financial group. Their prosperity was his first care, possibly because he believed that their prosperity was also the country's. It was such a man then that came to Mr. Warburg for advice. The labors of Senator Aldrich comprise many volumes of difficult material, and Senator Aldrich's appeal to Warburg was a very high compliment to the quality of the latter's mind and financial experience. This, of course, assuming that Warburg's counsel was not forced upon the Aldrich Committee by the New York monetary interests. In his testimony, I will share with you right now, Warburg did not tell all. The omission, however, was supplied in an article in Leslie's Weekly in the year 1916, the author being a gentleman named B.C. Forbes. Was that a member of the now well-known Forbes family? Don't know, but we're certainly going to look into it. It is a story of which the publication Current Opinion once said, it reads like the opening in a chilling shocker. You see, it appears that the conferences between Warburg and Senator Aldrich took place on an isolated island off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island. Included in the party, besides Senator Aldrich and Mr. Warburg, were two New York bankers and the then Assistant Treasurer of the United States. And the mysteriousness of it all was well brought out by Mr. Forbes. And we quote now from his rendering. Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York on a private railroad car under the cover of darkness, stealthily hiring hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking out to an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such rigid secrecy that the name of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servitors learn their identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret episode in the history of American finance. The utmost secrecy, the article continued, was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done. Aldrich notified each one to go quietly into a private car, which the railroad had received orders to draw up at an unfrequented platform. Drawn blinds balked any peering eyes that might be around. Off the party set, New York's ubiquitous reporters had been foiled. And so far, so good. After bowling along the railroad, rolling along the railroad hour after hour into southern country, the order was given to prepare to disembark. Stepping from the car when the station had been well cleared of travelers, the members of the expedition embarked in a small boat. Silence reigned, for the boatmen must not find out how distinguished were their passengers. In due time, they drew up at another deserted pier. They were at Jekyll Island, off Georgia. The island was entirely unpeopled, save for a half a dozen servants. The servants must, under no circumstances, learn who we are, cautioned Aldrich. What can we do to fool them? Asked another member of the group. The problem was discussed.
I have it, cried one. Let's all call each other by our first names. Don't ever let us mention our last names.
It was so agreed. The dignified veteran, Aldrich, King of Rhode Island and a powerful second to none in the United States Senate, became Just Nelson, and the quiet, scholarly member of the powerful international banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company became known as Paul. Nelson had meanwhile confided to Harry and Frank and Paul and Piot that he was to keep them locked up on Jekyll Island, cut off from the rest of the world, until they had evolved and compiled a scientific currency system for the United States, a system that would embody all that was best in Europe, and yet so modeled that it could serve a country measuring thousands, where European countries measured only hundreds of miles. Forbes does not omit to write this further description of Warburg's condition at the time. Unable to speak idiomatic English with perfect freedom and without an accent, an alien, not quite nationalized. Naturalized, I'm sorry. Forbes also wrote, here is a German-American, but the sort of one that makes the hyphen look like a badge of honor. That, my friends, was 1916. Hyphens went out of fashion, though not entirely out of use, soon afterwards. And thus far, my friends, that is the story of one Paul Warburg. But it's not the end of our story. That will be for another day. In our next installment of The Mask of Demetrius, Let the Games Begin, we are going to uncover the idea which molded the Federal Reserve Plan. The Federal Reserve Plan. It is of tremendous interest. What is this Siri Demetrius all about? You've talked to us about evil men, men who would murder and steal and cheat and lie. All we have done today, my friends, is to lay the groundwork. We're not going to recant the entire story of the Federal Reserve System and its founding. But please understand, it is imperative that we understand what it was all about. What the founding? What was their purpose? What was their reason? That's the groundwork we've attempted to lay tonight, and we'll lay a portion more of in Chapter 2 of The Mask of Demetrius. Let the games begin. And they shall.
Do you think we have time? Do you think we have time? These are the days of the open hand. We will not be the last. Look around now. These are the days of the beggars and the choosers. This is the year of the hungry man. whose place is in the past, hand in hand with the grunts and legitimate excuses. The rich declare themselves poor, and most of us are not sure if we have it too much, but we're taking our chances, say. I sang 20 years and a day, but nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flame. It's hard to love, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to hope when there is no hope to speak out. Wounded skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time. Do-do-do-oh. Or do you think we have hand? Oh, we hold on to what you can. And charity, charity is the coat you wear twice a year. Yeah, this is the year of the guilty man. Your television takes a stand, and you find that what was over there is over here. So you scream from behind your door, say what's mine is mine and not yours. I may have too much, but I'll take my chances, say. I sang 20 years and a day, there's nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flames. It's hard to love, Jesus, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to woe, there is no hope to speak out. In the wounded skies above, say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time.
Please call in at 800-313-9443 at 10 p.m. to enter the discussion. To book yourself as a guest, call our studio at 202-657-5715 or contact RBN staff. Remember, keep it real and take the red pill.
Is the Second Amendment your line in the sand? Is the United States Constitution important to you? Are you worried about gun confiscation? You need to join us for free at gunconfiscation.com. At gunconfiscation.com, you will meet like-minded patriots, get the latest Second Amendment news, and find anything you need to prepare for gun confiscation. Visit gunconfiscation.com today. That's gunconfiscation.com. Which side are you on?
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.